Good morning. Before we get started, I've been told by four different people that if you have not had your picture made for the directory, they are being done as we speak in the classroom annex, first floor, far end on the left. Today is the last day to have your picture taken if you want it to be in the directory. So if you haven't had your picture made, we assume that you don't want your picture to be in the directory. You may still have your picture made at a later date, but it will be in the supplement. But if you want to get up and avoid me teaching now and not appear to be rude, you may get up and excuse yourself and say, I'm going to take a picture. I'll be back, I promise. Nobody's leaving, so I guess everybody got their picture made. Y'all can confirm to all of my higher-ups that I made that announcement. All right, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Eric Allared. I'm originally from Montgomery, Texas. I did a four-year study abroad program in College Station, Texas, at a little school called Texas A&M, and now I live in Magnolia, Texas. So I'm very worldly traveled and well-cultured and lived in the same 90-mile radius all of my life. And I'm substituting this morning for Ken Stegall, who is visiting family. I think he's in Louisiana today. I took this class, this Romans class, when Ken had it in his home with, I guess, about five or six other couples. And it made a real big impact on me. And I think that's the reason he keeps asking me to substitute for him if he is out, whether it's over in the class next door or in here. And it's not something that I wear as a badge of honor, because what it means is that I probably needed the class worse than anybody else, which is why I'm so good at delivering the material, because it really hits home for me. Because I had some things a little bit wrong in my head, I guess is the easiest way to say it. I was raised in a very conservative Church of Christ, and we're going to talk about some things this morning, and y'all have been talking about all quarter that not necessarily fly in the face of what was taught, but they do give a much different perspective and a different kind of peace and security that I wasn't as familiar with as I am after having had the class with Ken. Y'all are still on the section of the class of condemnation, or how and why a person is lost. That's the part of the quarter that we're on right now. I can tell you, having been through the class twice, it does get better. But you can't get to and appreciate the good part of the class until you really grasp this part of the class, which is the real reason or the real cause of how and why a person is lost. And he's asked the question, I'm sure, every single class, and I'm going to ask it again. If Jesus Christ had never come to this earth, would man be lost or would man be saved? Lost. If we don't, I'm going to dwell a little bit on that. We don't have the whole morning to dwell on that, but I'm going to tell you a little bit from my perspective how I got over that, because I would answer correctly in our little class, but I didn't fully understand that. But you have to understand to get the full gravity of the class. And another reason that makes that question difficult to answer like that is that it kind of puts a little bit of pressure, not a little bit, it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on us as Christians to carry the word out to a lost and dying world. Because if you truly believe that someone is lost if they've never heard of Jesus Christ, then what's that mean? It's kind of on us, right? To take that word out, go ye into all of the world and preach the gospel to every living creature. You suppose when Jesus gave that great commission, we read it and read it and read it, and we go through it and we can probably quote it, but do you really understand how imperative it is to go into all of the world and preach the gospel? Why would it be so important to go into all of the world and preach the gospel if people were going to be okay without it? Right? Wouldn't be. So how's God going to judge the person in some dark corner of the world who's never heard of, much less read the Bible, they've never heard of baptism, they've never taken the Lord's Supper, how's he going to judge that person? Ken started on it last week. By the way, in the classes we used to say, or even Ken, and then I, following his lead, would say, well, picture somebody in the dark corner of Africa. Well, then we found out that our little place in Africa was downloading our sermons and lessons and listening to them, and so for fear that they may say, picture some redneck in Texas named Eric, we stopped and we just said, somewhere in a dark corner of the world. And you can use your imagination. Anyway, we have some person in a dark corner of the world, never heard of it, never seen a Bible, never heard of all this. How is God going to judge that person? Would it be fair for him to show up Judgment Day with a Bible and say, you didn't follow one lick of what's in here? That wouldn't be very fair, would it? Let me start by telling you how I used to answer that question. We said, how's God going to judge that person? And I'm probably not the only person that's ever answered it this way. Here's the answer. Well, I know that God is a God of love, and he's going to take care of that person. Now, does that sound good? Yeah, it sounds good. Does it sound noble? It does. Is it a satisfactory answer? To some, but not really when you delve into the question. Let's ask another question. And this is not a trick question. If something is a trick question, I will usually preface it and say, this is a trick question. This is not a trick question. Are we saved because we're baptized? Are we saved when we're baptized? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, we are saved when we're baptized. That is what we refer to as a deep truth. There's no getting around that. And Lord willing, when Ken is back and you get all the way to Romans chapter 6, you might, just like I do, have a whole nother appreciation, or at least a deeper appreciation for baptism. Better yet, well, let's ask another one, though. Are we lost because we're not baptized? No. Let's phrase it another way. Is someone lost because they reject the gospel? Is someone lost because? Someone may be lost if they reject the gospel. Are they lost because they reject the gospel? Go back to our guy in the dark corner of the world. He's never heard the gospel, therefore he's never rejected it. Right? Are we lost because we reject the gospel, or are we lost if and when we reject the gospel? We may be lost if we reject it, but the reason, the cause of us rejecting is not the cause of us being lost. And give me a little bit of attention. And if I don't clear it up, Ken will be here next week, so we don't have to worry about it. I'm going to use an example that helped me work through this. Like I said, I was raised in a pretty conservative church in my childhood, probably not unlike many of you. And maybe I misunderstood the message from the beginning, and that's on me. Maybe not, but maybe it is. It was my understanding that if someone didn't obey the gospel, they were lost. And that is true to an extent. That is true to an extent. But the reason they are lost is not because they didn't obey the gospel. Go back to the question. If someone lost because he or she hadn't obeyed the gospel, the answer is no. That's how we are saved. Obeying the gospel is how we are saved. Didn't have anything to do with us getting lost. Does that make sense? That part didn't have anything to do with why we're lost. It has everything to do with how we get saved, but nothing to do with how we got lost. Here's the problem. if it's true that if someone rejects the gospel, that's when they're lost. Here's the problem with that. Go back to my answer that I felt wasn't satisfactory. My God's a God of love, and he's going to take care of that person that I can't get the message to. That way I can sleep better at night, and I don't have to worry about getting the gospel out as much as I think I did. If we believe that, and we believe that someone's lost when they reject the gospel, because they reject the gospel, then answer me this question. Why in the world would you ever risk taking on the gospel? God compels you to, right? But if I believe that they're going to get lost the minute they reject the gospel, and that there's even a small chance that God might take care of them if they've never heard of it before, why would I roll the dice and take it to them? I wouldn't, right? Let me ask this question. Do you consider that good news? If you're worried that you're going to take somebody to the gospel and they've rejected, then they're lost. Is that good news? I don't think that's what God had in mind when he called it the good news. That's not good news. Now, have you ever, let me ask you this, I'm talking about myself. Have you ever not invited a friend or coworker to church because deep down you're afraid they might not agree with what's said? I have. What if they don't believe? Then what have I done? I've put them in a horrible predicament. Like I said, I don't think I had a very clear understanding, and this class helped me a lot. Now remember, you have to look at these 1:1 through 3:20 as we don't have a solution yet to our sin problem. It's hard for us in this room to do that because we know the solution. But at this point, in this context of the text, we don't have a solution. Paul is going through these gyrations to prove to us that if you are trying to be good by doing more right than you do wrong, or by trying to live under law, is another way to say that, he has news for you. It's not going to be done. Yes, sir.
Well, the good news is good news no matter what. I mean, that doesn't change. Maybe I'm missing something.
No, you're correct. The good news is good news no matter what.
The opportunity. I mean, opportunity is all we have.
That's right. It's not our job to convert people. It is our job to carry the message out to the lost and dying world. What they choose to do with it is their business, but it is on us, and it is imperative to us to take the gospel to every living creature. Yes, ma'am. That's right. If you already believe that someone is lost without the gospel, they won't get any more lost, is what she's saying. So taking the gospel, nothing but good can come of that. Nothing but good can come of that if you take it to them. Right. They're already down there. All right. Let's read. Somebody turn to Luke 19, verse 10. If you get there, shoot your hand up, and I'll just have you read it. Or it might be better in class this size if I just read it. I didn't think about that. Luke 19, verse... I'm used to teaching in a really small class. Y'all are very intimidating. I'll read it real. Luke 19, verse 10. For the Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. That which was lost. Matthew 18, verse 11 says the exact same thing. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. It was lost before Christ ever got on this earth. I skipped through that verse a lot in my youth. Now, I know what you're thinking in the back of your head right now, and I'm not going to answer that question this morning. Your question is, what happened before? Ken will get to that. I promise you, if you come to this class and go through this whole quarter, that question does get answered. And clearly answered. Not ambiguously answered. It gets answered. So I will give you a hint. It's the exact same way that we're saved now. Yeah, it's the exact same way we're saved now. But anyway, the point of all this is we have to, as a church and as Christians, believe that people outside of Christ are lost. Were lost, have been lost, and will continue to remain lost unless we take them the solution, unless we carry the good news to them. That's the point. Now, last week, you got into how God is going to judge that person that's trying to live under law. How is he going to? And there's three principles, and they're outlined in chapter 2 of Romans. The first one is, and this remember, and you can put a little note right there in chapter 2 if you want to. This whole chapter deals with how God judged the man under law, that is, without Christ. This is how God judges the man or the human under law. Number one was self-condemnation. That's when he said, have you ever told somebody to do something that you yourself knew was wrong to do, or you went and did it anyway after telling them not to do it? You heard the adage, don't say anything good if you can't say anything. Don't say anything if you can't say anything good at all. Okay. But of course, we follow that up by saying, you know, that's unless the person isn't around and isn't going to find out, right? We follow it up with that, don't we? No. We say, if you don't have something nice to say, you don't say anything at all. And then what do? We turn around and say something not so nice about someone or to someone, or about someone to someone. If we do that, and we believe it to be wrong, we have at that point knowingly crossed that threshold. We had a standard of right and wrong. At the moment we crossed that own standard that we put, we transgressed the law. Anybody know another word for transgressing the law? Sin. A missing of the mark, however you want to define it. Not however you want to define it, that's how it's defined. Now, so we got self-condemnation, that's the second one. I mean, that's the first one. The second one is, every person has God-given law. That's number two. And we discovered that in verses 12 through 14 or 15. Remember, now 12 goes directly to 16, but there's a parenthetical between there. Verses 13 through 15 are a parenthesis, which is to emphasize a point. But we'll read through it real quick. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves. They do by nature the things that are written on the law. He talked about the example, you know, was it wrong to kill before Exodus chapter 20? When were the Ten Commandments? Exodus 20. Was it wrong to kill before Exodus 20? Right. How do we know that? At least one example. Cain and Abel, right? And he made the point that when God came and asked Cain, where's your brother Abel? Did he say, he's dead right over there, I killed him? No, he didn't say that. He said, ain't my day to watch him. I don't know where he is. Why would Cain have done that if he didn't know that killing was wrong? He would not have done that if he didn't know killing was wrong. He knew it was wrong to kill. Just like somebody in a dark corner of the earth knows it's wrong to kill and knows it's wrong to steal. Now, there are different thresholds for that across the human race and across different cultures and across society. We have different points at which we put our plank in and say, can't go above that point. I can't do anything worse than that. Somebody else may be down here, somebody else will be up here. But that's the way that it is. He started with an example of an indigenous tribe that they believed they gained strength by when they killed their enemies and ate their hearts, kind of gory. But they believed they gained. So clearly, they have a different standard of thou shalt not kill than, say, we do in this room or some other indigenous people. But let's take that example a step further, and it is a little gory, but if you will indulge me, it'll help make a point. You got that same tribe of indigenous people that does that. They kill their enemies, they eat their hearts, they gain the strength. That's what they believe. They've had a big day of battle, and they defeated another tribe, and they're back at the campfire, and they're celebrating, and one guy who did an amazingly good job, he's being really lauded and applauded at how well he did by the whole tribe. and he's tired, and he falls asleep at the campfire. Another one of the tribesmen, who's a little bit jealous of all the notoriety this guy's getting, is angry. He lets his jealousy turn to anger. He enters the tent of the family where the guy's sleeping. Remember, he's out of the campfire. Family's in there. Slits the throat of his wife, baby daughter, and newborn son. Now, does someone need to come and tell that guy who's asleep at the campfire that it's wrong to kill? Or is he going to wake up and find that out and know that? He's going to wake up, find out what happened in his tent. Is he going to say, well, you know, I guess they just died, just killed him? I don't think so. Even that person has a threshold for thou shalt not kill, doesn't he? There has. And where did they get that? Written on their hearts, Romans tells us. Where did they get that distinction? They had to get it from somewhere. It's written on your heart. Now, it is shaped by society, and it is shaped by one's upbringing, and it is shaped by your culture, sometimes perverted, but it's written on your heart. Even a serial killer in prison has a threshold for sin, for knowing when they have done right and knowing when they have done wrong. That's number two. Number three is embedded in verse 15. This is one we didn't get to last week. Number three is the number three way that God's going to judge a man living under law without Christ. Your conscience will testify. So even if you choose to ignore the fact that you did something incorrectly, or that you transgressed the law, or that you went below your standard, God's not going to need the Bible, God's not going to need those things to judge you. Let's read. It's a continuation from verse 14. In that they, talking about Gentiles, people under moral law, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. My conscience bearing witness. What is a conscience? Anybody? It's not a trick question. Yeah, it's the little voice inside you that says, I don't know, Eric, we're approaching that threshold that we've set. Yes, ma'am. Sure it is. Yeah, all these end up working together. And by the way, they end up working against you, but they end up working together. Your conscience, it's how we know we've done something wrong, or when we're approaching something that we think might end up being wrong. It's the feeling deep in your gut won't let you sleep at night. You ever lose sleep because of you feeling guilty? I never have, but people may have. We've established that God's not going to need to use the Bible to judge people that are under law, that aren't living underneath. You're either under law or you're under grace. If you're not under grace, you're under law. If you want to be judged under law, these are some things you need to know. This is how you're going to be judged. The verse here sets a scene, and it sets a courtroom scene. And I'm on trial, the old Eric, trying to live under law. I'm the guy on trial. God is the judge. And for fear that I may incriminate myself, I'm not going to testify. God says, no problem. I'll call a different witness. And he reaches into my chest, and he pulls out my conscience, and he sets it on the witness stand. And now I'm sweating bullets, right? Because I know that he knows what I've done. Because he's the one that told me it wasn't right to do it. Now, he's going to ask it. Eric's conscience, has Eric ever done anything that you told him not to do? Now, if my conscience is really smart, maybe he's even had a witness coach. And he's going to ask that the question be rephrased. He didn't understand it. Could you please rephrase the question? So then the question will come maybe something like this. he's going to say, has Eric ever done anything at any point in his life, anything, one thing, that grated against you, his conscience, and you subsequently pestered Eric about it, so much so that you caused him to lose sleep, maybe be angry with himself, and eventually ignore you, his conscience, about the issue altogether? Did that ever happen, conscience? So now what's the problem? I'm toast, right? Because the conscience is probably going to say, well, how much time do you have today? Because we could be here a while. We say it in jest, but that's exactly what the Bible tells us is going to happen if you try to live under law and you try to keep law. That scene is what's going to happen. Yes, sir. Yes, he is. Whatever standard they chose to live by. That's right. Yeah, verses 1 through 16. It's, well, when I, let me be real clear. When I say law, I'm talking about both, moral law and law of Moses. When I say law in this context, and most of the time it's saying law in this context, it does say that. In fact, there's many places where it's emphasized and capitalized where it probably shouldn't be. And because it's confusing. There's verses like that in Galatians. But when it's talking about living under law, there's two types of law. There's moral law and there's law of Moses. Jews live under law of Moses. God's saying that Gentiles everywhere, the whole rest of the earth, has some type of a moral law written on their hearts. The point is, either way, whether you're living under the law of Moses or living under moral law, you can't keep it. You're not good enough. Verses 1 through 16 is the conviction of the Gentiles. You can jot this down. Verses 17 through 29 is the conviction of the Jews. We won't go into 17 through 29 today, but that's what it is. If you read 17 through 29... the Jews have probably been kicked back saying, yeah, Paul, you get them. You tell them Gentiles how they're going to be judged living under law. They can't do it. And then in verse 17, he says, if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law, and he goes in, he said, now, all right, Jews, you want to talk about living under law? Let's talk about those 600 and some odd laws and how well you keep those. So either way you choose to live, moral law, Mosaic law, it's not going to work. Now, so is my conscience a perfect guide?
No.
Exactly. My conscience is not a perfect guide because I can choose to ignore it, right? It isn't easy at first, but it gets easier, right? It bothers you a little bit at first. It might bother you a lot at first, but eventually you ignore it long enough, it will quit bothering you. Yes. That's exactly right. You're shaped by the environment. All this being said, if you don't have anything else, it's a pretty good barometer to use in most situations, is it not? I mean, in fact, I would even submit that its imperfectness is all the more reason to heed it when it is bothering you. If you are consciously aware that your conscience is flawed and may have been seared, and it's still bothering you about a certain situation, what might that say about that certain situation? Probably someplace you need to run from. Right? So it can be, you know, it can be seared, it can be ignored, but by and large, it is something that we probably should listen to. So that's the three principles of how God's going to judge a person trying to live under law, law of Moses or moral law. Either way, this is how God's going to judge them. Self-condemnation or self-judgment. All men have God-given law, and your conscience will testify. So if we've talked all about this law, and how bad, what good is law to us? Can law justify us? Doesn't sound like it. There is a caveat. There is. Turn to Galatians 3, verse 10. It can justify you, but it is conditional. And I would submit that it is highly conditional. So much so that it's borderline, not borderline, it is hypothetical. Galatians 3, verse 10 says, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse." So there's a curse associated with trying to live under law. Here's the curse. And he's going to quote Deuteronomy chapter 27. "For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law to perform them." So what's the curse if you want to live under law? You have to do the whole law perfect every time. Now, I'll ask the question again. Is there anybody in this room that the law can justify? I don't think so. Not if that's the condition. And that is the condition. Yeah, there we go. The next verse tells you, Paul draws a conclusion, does he not? He draws the conclusion and says it's now that we have established the fact, in other words, now that no one is justified by the law before God is evident. So in reading verse 10, he made his point, right? Is what he's saying. Now that we've got that out of the way and established the fact that nobody is going to live perfectly under law, and that's going to be evident, now we can move on to something else. And that's what he does. He goes into a dissertation on faith, which we will get to, or y'all will get to. I get to go back to my class. But y'all will get to faith. We're not there yet, but you'll get there. Now, so is law bad? No, absolutely not. It's actually a very, very good thing. For instance, can you imagine living in a society that didn't have law? Raise your hand if that's someplace you would like to live. A society that isn't bound by laws. Nobody. So what's the point of law? Structure, order, sets boundaries, right? Sets boundaries for a society. There's nothing wrong with the law. The law is not the problem. What's the problem? I can't keep it. That's the problem. There's nothing wrong with the law. It's this guy. I can't make it happen. It doesn't have any compassion. The law does not. It doesn't show any mercy. It doesn't offer any redemption unless you live it perfectly. So the law can't save you. The law can't justify you. It can only condemn you, at least you and me. That's all it can do. Yes, ma'am. Ah, yes. Here we go. The purpose of law. Let's go to Galatians. Back to Galatians chapter 3. The purpose of law. A little bit, skip down a little bit from where we were. We're going to start in verse 21. Galatians chapter 3, verse 21. He's going to ask the same questions we've just been asking. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? May it never be. Absolutely not. For if a law had been given which was able to impart life, then righteousness would indeed have been based on law. Stop there. What Paul's saying is that if mankind could have been saved by any other way than God having his son having to be murdered, don't you think God would have allowed that to happen? You've heard people say that God could have picked any way he wanted to save the world. I don't necessarily believe that. Because I don't think God would have chosen having his own son murdered on a tree would have been the way he chose. Do you? I would submit to you this morning that that's the only way that it could have happened. And we'll get there in this study of Romans. Why? That's the only way it would have worked. But that's what Paul's telling us, that if righteousness could have come by law, then surely it would have come by law. Verse 22, but the Scripture has shut up everyone under sin. In other words, it has convicted everybody, if you read it, so that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. Verse 23, but before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Here's our verse. Therefore, the law has become our tutor. The King James says schoolmaster, to lead us to Christ so that we may be justified by faith. Wouldn't be a good Bible class if we didn't throw out a Greek word, right? The Greek word that's used there for tutor or schoolmaster, whatever you have in your translation, is pedagogos or pedagogog. And the Greek word means, the best thing we can relate it to these days is kind of a hybrid between a nanny and a drill sergeant. Okay, if you can picture such a person. Be an interesting person, but that's what it is. What it was back in the, you know, only the male children went to school. And it was generally either a slave or a freed person, so a former slave, that was literally charged with the care and the well-being of that man child, that child. They literally walked them to school every day, walked them home every day, set them down, made sure they had food, made sure they had water, kept them from going astray when they were walking to school. Seen Pinocchio? I see a lot. I have a four-year-old. But it kept them from going somewhere other than school. It kept them, made sure they, when they got home, they got something to eat, because kids don't know any better. Guardian is a great one. But it doesn't give it an edgy enough, because we're going to get to it in a minute. Because what law does, the more law you find out or the more law that's revealed to you, what happens? Yeah, the more it beats you up, right? The more guilt you expose yourself to, or at least the possibility of more guilt you expose yourself to. They're usually entrusted people. It restrains us. The law restrains us. It rebukes us. The law does. It tells you when you've veered off course. It tells you when you've overstepped the boundary. It teaches you, like our sister said, those things. The whole purpose of the law, there's a visual we'll try. And what's happening here is someone's going through life trying to live by law. And at every single turn, they discover something new about law. And everywhere you look, as you're on this journey, climbing a mountain, if you can visualize it like that, you look up, and the law tells you you're going to die because you transgressed it. You look down, and the law tells you you're going to die because you transgressed it. You look to the left, and the law tells you you're going to die. You look to the right, the law tells you you're going to die, because we know that the wages of sin is death. Somebody has to die. And so the law beats us and restrains us and drives us until we're literally on our knees. And we come to the realization, finally, that we cannot do it on our own. I cannot live good enough. I can't do enough right. And we look up, weary, beaten, and we see a cross. And we realize we don't have to do it on our own. And the law comes up and taps you on the shoulder and says, I'm out of here. My job is done. Because the purpose of law is to lead us to Christ. That's the purpose of law. So is law a good thing? Yes, sir. It's a good thing. Is it something that you want to be bound to whenever you go before judgment? Not this kid. I don't want that because I haven't kept it. So we have understood the curse of law, which is what? You got to live every single perfectly, okay? All the time. We've discovered the purpose of law, which is what? Lead us to Christ. To show us how sinful we really are. And to show us that no matter how good we try to be, and no matter how much I shave, and believe it or not, how much I comb my hair, and what kind of clothes I wear, that none of that makes you any better. And nothing you try to do will make you justified by law. And then we also talked about the three ways, or the three principles of how God is going to judge that person who is living under law. And the law is what? It encompasses two different laws, law of Moses and moral law. All right? And those are, number one, self-judgment or self-condemnation. Number two, all men have God-given law. And number three, our conscience are going to bear witness. Our conscience is going to testify. Now let's go back a little bit and clarify some of the things of our first question. Or answer it even. If Jesus had never come to this earth, would man be lost or would man be saved? Man would be lost. Every single man and woman. Because we're going to read in the latter part of the middle of verse of chapter 3 that when he says in Galatians that the whole world was shut up, it says the whole world would be made silent and stand before God condemned under law. Any questions or comments? Class ends at 20 after, is that right? About? What kind of questions or comments do you have? It's hard in a class this size. This material is a lot more effective in a more intimate group, but the message can be done. Yes, sir. That's right. Yeah, I mean, his point is that which is what Paul told us in Galatians 3:10, is that you can be justified by law. You can do it. Well, you can hypothetically do it. And that is, all you got to do is live perfect. That's it. Piece of cake. Elton. Very good comment. For those of you who didn't hear, he said that it wouldn't be fair if law couldn't be kept, but Jesus demonstrated that, in fact, it could be kept. And what other questions or comments? Yes.
Five minutes.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, and really, if you're trying to do it under moral law, the rules are no different. From the minute that alarm clock goes off in the morning, what are the thoughts going through your head? I don't want to go to work. Well, let's start that next day, Groundhog Day. We already sinned that day because I'm not grateful for my job. Next day, something else happens. Yes.
The same thing goes for conscience. Some of us in here might have conscience here.
Yeah, no, if you rely on your conscience to be your everyday guide as what's going to get you through life, you're going to be in a heap of trouble. Because our consciences are, we pervert them. Our society, our decisions, the things that we do.
When Ken said, is it important to know the Bible, that's exactly
why it's important. Yeah, we'll get, when, like I said, this part of the class, we're dealing with people trying to live under law. We're going to get to the solution. It does get better. That's the whole point of all this. And you do have to obey the gospel to be saved. There's no question on that. Because we're lost beforehand. You have to do that. Yes, ma'am. There you go. Yeah, he's going to talk about, in Romans chapter 4, he says that. He said Abraham may have something to boast about if he kept it, but not before God. He's just doing what he's supposed to do. If you keep law perfectly, you don't have anything to boast about. Yeah, we have gray areas, our standards, but the law does not. I'm just very thankful he offered a different solution, personally. That's all I got this morning. Ken will be back next week, so hit him with the hard questions.